Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where Rob Mundell makes his first appearance at the Sydney Institute on the occasion of the publication of his most recent book, Cook from Sailor to Legend. Rob Mundell will be known to some of you here. He started off as a journalist. He told me recently that he was the first cadet journalist employed on the Australian in Sydney in 1964. It's the Australian's 50th anniversary next year. And he's also worked with Channel 10 and as a freelancer, but more recently as an author. He is the author of the best-selling book Fatal Storm on the 1998 Sydney to Hobart yacht race, and he's also published other books, including studies of Bly, who used to hang out next door on the old government house site, and we're sort of in his backyard here, because it's just behind us, which was also the site of the Rum Rebellion, as it's called, and a book on Flinders, and now most recently a book on James Cook. And so it's welcome to Rob Mundell tonight, who's going to speak for us on James Cook's three remarkable voyages of discovery in the Pacific. Rob Mundell, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Jared, and welcome everyone. For me, it's indeed a great honour to be with you tonight, and it's lovely to see that I think we've got a full house, which is very exciting as well. I guess really I should start by making a bit of a confession, because Cook from Sailor to Legend is my 13th book, but until I wrote the first of this trilogy, which was the Bly Master Mariner, I never really saw myself as being an author, writer of Australian maritime history. But I am, and I have to say I've never been happier. I think I've really found a niche in life that's been waiting to be for me to fill it as personally, and it's a wonderful thing. The link between Bly, Flinders and Cook is that Bly sailed with Cook and Flinders sailed with Bly. Flinders was with Bly on the voyage back to Tahiti after the mutiny, the second voyage where he went to collect the breadfruit and get the breadfruit through to the West Indies, where it was to be used, or the fruit from the trees to be used as food for the slaves there. The interesting thing, as we know, the first voyage there was a mutiny, deaths and lots of problems, and then on the second voyage Bly was successful, only to get the breadfruit to the West Indies. But once the fruit was produced, the slaves refused to eat it because they hated it. So two voyages really went to waste. It really was through the unwavering encouragement of Helen Littleton, who is here this evening as publisher from HarperCollins, and as well Hachette. I refer to her as MFP, my favourite publisher, that I really did venture into writing maritime history. And I'm so glad that she insisted, and persisted for that matter. Helen's, as I say now, with ABC HarperCollins, that wonderful organisation that has published the Cook book, as we refer to it. I'd also like tonight to recognise the presence of Paul Brunton, the Emeritus Curator of the State Library of New South Wales, because when you're writing a book like this, your biggest fear is fact and getting things right. And Paul was an enormous help in guiding me through so much of this book and commenting on my copy and just making sure that we were on course. I did actually, it did actually, from Helen in particular, take a lot of convincing to get me to write this book, only because there were so many books about the subject matter, James Cook, out there already over a couple of centuries, really. And I struggled to grasp where I might be able to create a book that was a little bit different, something different, something entertaining, something interesting, something beneficial. My research really did convince me before too long that I could achieve that, I could come up with something different. And that was to place considerable emphasis on the seafaring side of the man's life, while also recognising his remarkable achievements as an explorer. This also could be done through my life as a competitive sailor and a career journalist, and also obviously as an author. I stress, really, for the benefit of everyone, I'm not an academic, I'm not a historian, but I'm actually what I consider to be a storyteller. One enthusiastic reader of mine recently said, I make history readable, and I think that's the highest compliment that I could be paid. It really makes things worthwhile for me. My own family heritage is very much with the sea, back to the era of square riggers, and until yesterday I was led to believe that that heritage was firmly entrenched in New Zealand, where Captain Joseph Mundell sailed square riggers from England and into New Zealand to Nelson and to Wellington carrying migrants. But only yesterday I discovered my family actually had distinct ties with Sydney's early maritime history. In the April 25 edition, actually, of in 1885 of the Sydney Morning Herald, there was a story about the square rigger Commodore Perry, which had just sailed into Sydney from Liverpool in England, carrying migrants. The story described the Commodore Perry as one of the largest and finest vessels that has entered this harbour. The ship carried 312 passengers and a cargo that included 300 tonnes of coal and 2,250 sacks of salt. I don't know for what. But the captain of that vessel was Captain G. Mundell, and he had his family on board as well. Captain George Mundell was my great-great-grandfather, so I found that news with some level of pride. I'm a senior member of this generation that hasn't gone to sea to earn a living, but the first time ever, but my life certainly is close to that. My own sailing experiences started as a two-year-old, as you would expect, in a plywood boat in the middle of the backyard at the family home in Cremorne, with a broomstick for a mast and a bedsheet for a sail, and I sailed around the world countless times. Then, when I was 7 years old, we moved to Colorado Plateau and I went into square riggers. I found an old tomato case, found another broomstick, nailed that to the tomato case, got a roll-up Holland blind, tied that onto the top of the mast, and every time the wind blew, I was in the backyard sitting in the tomato case with a sail full of wind and heading off to God knows where, but it was always fun. My first real sailing experience came when I was 11, Middle Harbour Skiff Club. Three other boys my age jumped into a 12-foot sailboat to go out and race, which we won. But from the moment we pushed off the beach and the wind filled the sail, the boat heeled over, the boat started accelerating, there was the gurgle of the bow wave, I knew I was gone. I knew I'd found my lot in life, and from then on I've been absolutely tied in with sailing. But now back to the book. Having researched the cookbook as I did, I can say that it's quite possible that it was a wisp of wind, one that was barely discernible, that became the reason for us being here tonight. That's quite possible, believe it or not. Or more specifically, for the first fleet arriving here and establishing the settlement just a short distance away in Sydney Cove. And I'll actually explain why. After Lieutenant Hicks, who spelled his name H-I-C-K-E-S, but Captain Cook always spelled it without the E, so we have Point Hicks, had first sighted the coast of New Holland 4 months earlier from the deck of the Bark Endeavour, Cook had sailed the ship north, exploring the east coast of the newly discovered land. And as we know, he discovered Botany Bay and a lot of other points along the coast. Now, if I asked any of you here what was the most traumatic, the most dangerous, the most memorable moment of that voyage up the coast, I'm sure everyone would say, when he ran aground on Endeavour Reef and the ship was almost lost, etc., etc. And then the ship was taken into Cooktown, as it is today, and into the Endeavour Reef and repaired there. But really, I don't believe that that was the most dangerous moment. After repairing his ship over 7 weeks on the banks of the Endeavour River, Cook realised the only way he could then find a safe passage to the north was to escape the dangers that were confronting his progress, an ever-increasing number of large coral reefs that were lurking just below the surface. He'd already found one a little bit earlier. So he had to find a way out through the reef, get into the deep water, find a gap somewhere in the outer barrier of the reef. And that he did just to the east of Lizard Island. Then once outside, he knew that he still had to stay either in touch with the coast or be able to sail along parallel to that reef, because his next object was to decide, was there a gap, was there a pass between the tip of this unknown coast and New Guinea, or was it all one? So he came back in after a bit of a rest out there, close to the outer reef, deciding he really didn't want to go back inside again, and started paralleling that. But about 48 hours after he first entered the deep water, he was riding a very nice breeze. It was going into the night, but then he decided that he would turn and go back on a reciprocal course because he didn't want to proceed into unknown waters. They did that a lot. They'd sail by day, turn around and come back at night, so they knew they were in safe water, then go again in daylight hours. Suddenly, that breeze evaporated, and almost immediately it became apparent that the current and a huge ocean swell were sending the ship and its 90-plus crew towards a massive tsunami of white water that was thundering onto the reef just a couple of miles away. Despite his determined efforts to save his ship, and by having all three of Endeavour's small boats manned and trying to tow the ship to safety, all was in vain. Anchoring was out of the question. Plumbing the depths with the lead line revealed the bottom could not be found at 150 fathoms, about 300 metres. That's the height of the Eiffel Tower in Paris. This dire circumstance was not lost on Joseph Banks, the young naturalist representing the Royal Society who was aboard Endeavour. Banks wrote, "Our case was truly desperate. No man, I believe, but who gave himself entirely over. A speedy death was all we had to hope for, and that from the vastness of the breakers, which must quickly dash our ship all to pieces, was scarce to be doubted. Other hopes we had none." Of the same situation, Cook wrote, "It was 6 o'clock, and we were not above 80 or 100 yards from the breakers. The same sea that washed the sides of the ship rose in a breaker prodigiously high the very next time it did rise, so that between us and destruction was only a dismal valley the breadth of one wave. We hardly had any hopes of saving the ship. Yet in this truly terrible situation, not one man ceased to do his utmost, and that with as much calmness as if no danger had been near. All the dangers we had previously escaped were little in comparison to being thrown upon this reef where the ship must be dashed to pieces in a moment." With certain annihilation then just metres away, the only hope for salvation arrived, and that was a gentle wisp of wind, barely enough to get pressure into the sails, but it was, and Endeavour moved a few boat lengths away from the edge of the reef. But then it died again. So suddenly, here is a ship drifting back towards the reef once more. Those on the quarterdeck, the lieutenants, etc., were throwing crunched up pieces of paper into the water to confirm that they were heading back to the reef. It was still dark at the time. Then suddenly, just again, when they're on the verge of being washed onto the reef, another puff came. This time, it was enough just to move them a little bit further. They were incredibly fortunate because the wind came from an offshore direction and blew them away from the reef. Then, miraculously, the tide also changed. So suddenly, Endeavour was safe. They were able to get the ship through a narrow channel an hour or so later and back inside the reef. They really had been to death's door, and all they could do at that stage, obviously, was count their blessings. It was Thursday, 16th of August, when that twist of fate, that quirk of nature in the form of that ever so gentle and unexpected puff of wind, actually changed the course of history. Cook and his men were spared from the inevitably fatal consequences of a horrendous shipwreck, one that would possibly have remained a maritime mystery forever. Cook would not have returned to England with any news of his two great discoveries at the time, the extent of New Zealand and the fact that it comprised two large islands, and the existence of the east coast of New Wales, which later, through an editing error in publishing, became New South Wales. Think of the possible scenario that had Endeavour's crew been lost. With the British back home in England not knowing the existence of this coast, the scene would not have been set for the creation of a penal colony here in 1788. As a consequence, it could well have led to the French flag or some other flying high over this land today. And we might have all been speaking French. Also, had Cook and his crew perished on the Great Barrier Reef at the time, the world would have been deprived of the man who would go on to become, as far as I'm concerned and many others, the greatest navigator, cartographer and maritime explorer of all time. Really, only Magellan and Vasco da Gama can stand close to Cook. Over his three voyages of discovery, Cook redrew the world map and made discoveries like no other. His first voyage of discovery started on 26 August 1768. At that time, one third of the world's surface had not been explored by the Europeans. It was essentially the area of the Pacific Ocean, some 63.8 million square miles. When he died less than 11 years later in such tragic and gruesome circumstances in Hawaii, or the Sandwich Islands as they were then, he had crisscrossed the vast majority of that region, making remarkable discoveries and naming more than 300 landmarks across the Pacific, from South America to New Zealand and Australia, the Antarctic region to the Arctic region, and in all the time searching for Terra Australis Incognita, or the Great Southern Land. There were many firsts, including being the first explorer to sail beyond both the Antarctic and Arctic circles, the first man to circumnavigate the world in opposite directions. He sailed more than 200,000 nautical miles over three incredible voyages. That's the equivalent of here to the moon. That really puts it into perspective. He was born on 17th of October 1728, the son of a farmer, a farm worker in Marton in Cleveland, in from the coast in Yorkshire. And really, if you look at his upbringing, he was born in what they called a biggin, which was a mud hut, mud floor, no facilities inside, probably no walls. He was destined to be a farmer. But his father got a job at a nearby farm as managing that farm. And in doing so, the Lord of the Manor took a distinct liking to young Cook, so much so that he paid for his education. And when Cook came to leave school at 12, it was very obvious to the Lord of the Manor that this young lad really did have an ability with numbers and with letters. And so soon after, for a little while after that, he did work with his father on the farm, but then it came time to get a job. And the same Lord of the Manor got him a job in a store in Staithes on the coast, 20, 25 miles to the east. Now, he got a job there in a grocer's store. But back in those days, a grocer's store wasn't what we know to be a grocer's store today. It was a store that sold things by the gross, for the house, for whatever. You went in and bought a gross of this and a gross of that. And so off he went to be trained to become someone, a shopkeeper, I guess, would be his career path at the time. But after a while, he became intrigued by the sea. The store was on the waterfront there. And he really got intrigued by the sailors, their stories, the feeling of the sea. And legend has it that the tipping point was the moment Cook decided to really pursue a completely different career. That came on a day when a well-weathered sailor strolled into the store and used a South Seas Company one-shilling piece to pay for a purchase. Young James is said to have looked at it as if it was an omen guiding him to his future. It was as though it held magical powers. The thought of the South Seas was conjuring up a thousand stories about distant lands. The die was cast. Within a year of arriving in Staithes, he had moved to Whitby, only 10 miles down the coast to the south, where he signed on to become an apprentice on coastal colliers carrying coal up and down the coast, obviously under sail. He did that for a decade, and then he was offered the role of to become a master of a collier. But he decided that that wasn't his future. He'd done enough, he'd learnt enough there. He could then, if he wanted to go for more adventure, become a merchant sailor and cross the Atlantic or sail to the West Indies. He did the Whitsundays. He wanted to join the Navy. He wanted to go beyond. He wanted excitement. So he did join the Navy. But he was actually 26 years old when he joined the Navy. And that didn't matter. He had to start life on the lower deck with all the riffraff, some of the most undesirables you can imagine, but there he was. That he wanted to join the Navy, he accepted that, and he went to the lower deck. He joined the first ship he joined was the HMS Eagle, and later he went aboard the Pembroke. Aboard the Eagle, he got to see battle off the coast of France, because it was the start of the Seven-Year War. And then he went with HMS Pembroke and saw more battles with the Siege of Louisbourg and the Siege of Quebec. He became recognised for his ability as a cartographer and a navigator, particularly in the St Lawrence River, where he sorted out where the channels lay and did everything possible with others, obviously, to get the ships all the way up the river, about 100 plus miles to Quebec, so that they could take on the French. And that eventually, as we know, led to the French being removed from the northern part of America. After the war was over, he went back to Newfoundland and as a surveyor, a cartographer, because he'd met Samuel Holland, who was the great Royal Navy cartographer, who was land-based and surveyor, surveying all of the majority of North America. And his job after the Siege of Louisbourg was to do that. Cook met him one day, became intrigued, they struck up a friendship, and Holland passed on so much of his knowledge on surveying and everything else to Cook. And that was one of the great benefits, one of the great meetings for Cook in his entire life. During this time, he married Elizabeth Batts. Now, she was 14 years his junior, but we could never really work out. No one knows what happened. Where did the relationship start? How did it come about? Why did they meet? Or anything else? Because his wife, at the time of Cook's death, burnt every communication, disposed of every communication the two of them had between each other. So to this day, there's no really accurate information relating to that relationship, except primarily that they had six children. And the interesting thing is, it's just quite strange that 9 months after every time Cook was home, a child was born. I can't work that one out. So, anyway, at this similar sort of time, or soon after that, the Royal Society knew that the transit of Venus was coming. It was then would be 120 years before the next one. And at that period, the transit of Venus represented the opportunity to more accurately calculate the distance of the planets. Earth from the Sun, Venus from the Sun, Venus from Earth. The reason they needed this information, because with navigation, while they could work out longitude relatively easy through angles of the Sun, they couldn't accurately get the latitude right. They couldn't get the longitude right. And because they couldn't get longitude right, it was leading to disaster after disaster on the high seas. If they could get this transit of Venus done properly, then they could have the information where they could calculate longitude far more accurately for the benefit of everyone. So they decided to do that, the Royal Society. Long story short, was in doing that, they decided to, if I'm jumping too fast, you can always buy the book and fill in the gaps, by the way. decided that they would send someone to three points on the planet where they could get it. By spreading out the points of where they could observe the transit, their information could be far more accurate. So Wallace had just discovered Tahiti, and the Royal Society decided that Tahiti would be the destination for the observation in the South Pacific, and that was the most important one. And after great consideration, it came about that James Cook, who had come to their notice through his efforts of surveying and in North America, in Newfoundland, and etc., would be the master of that voyage. So, fortunately for Cook, and I think maybe on his suggestion, it was a Whitby Collier that was chosen, the Earl of Pembroke, to be the vessel for that voyage. The primary reason for that was it was the shape of the vessel. She was round, she was fat, she had a very bold hull. And that was so she could carry so much coal. But Cook realised that in going into these unknown waters with a vessel that shape, and not what we call a slack-bilge vessel, a very V-shape, if ever the vessel did run aground, it would get a lot of buoyancy from the rising tide by a long, wide flat hull to help lift her off the bottom and really escape the dramas. If it was a V-shaped hull, she'd probably lie on her side and may not even come upright. So he, Cook then, in the first voyage, 1768, headed off on the Earl of Pembroke, which was named H.M. Bark Endeavour, for that voyage. And they went off to Tahiti. Now, when he left, he was given his instructions from his orders from the Royal Navy, the Admiralty, telling him that he was to go to Tahiti and do this. He also had a secret set of instructions, which few, if any, apart from him, were aware of that. They went off to Tahiti. Their observations of the transit were remarkably successful. With that complete, he decided it was, well, he knew it was then time to move on, but he opened the new orders, and it was that you were to go in search of the Great Southern Land, the Terra Australis Incognita, to see where it is, to see if it does exist. Because there was a theory with a lot of people in Europe, and I'm sure as most of you know, that there had to be a huge landmass somewhere down in the southern hemisphere just to counter the weight of all this land that was up in the northern hemisphere. And if that didn't exist, well, the Earth would keep capsizing. So there's got to be something there to create a balance. That was the theory back in the day. So anyway, the secret instructions told him that. And he was to probe down to the southern latitudes, to the latitude, in fact, of where Tasman had come across 120 years earlier or so, and found the west coast of New Zealand. So Cook left Tahiti, went way down to the Southern Ocean, and couldn't find anything. And the weather turned really bad, so he said, we're out of here, and did a U-turn and came up into the higher latitudes to better weather, and then gave up on going any further south and aimed for the point where Tasman gave his latitude and longitude for the west coast of New Zealand. In doing that, he knew that if he aimed for that and got to that point, he would definitely hit land somewhere. Now, there was a theory that New Zealand might have been part of the Great Southern Land, also that it might have extended way down into the Southern Ocean and gone across and joined South America somewhere near Staten Island. That's why Tasman called it Staten Land when he first discovered it. So he went across there, and sure enough, he hit the east coast of the North Island of New Zealand while he was aiming for that point. He circumnavigated New Zealand as a consequence of that. He proved that it was two islands. He had terrible times with the Maoris. They were confronted by the Maoris at all times, and it was interesting to note that as they progressed, Cook became increasingly concerned by the fact that it was becoming apparent that they were cannibals. And one of the times that became apparent was when they were sailing along the coast. They had two Maoris on board. Other Maoris paddled out to them in canoes. And the English tried to hail the others to come over and so they could give them gifts and extend friendship. And they wouldn't come anywhere near the boat. It wasn't until the two Maoris on board convinced the others that these white people didn't eat men that they then came to the vessel. So more evidence that cannibalism existed. So Cook, it was a terribly dangerous voyage around New Zealand on so many occasions, but it always was. And that's one of the things that amazes me about this man. Great seafarer. He just managed all the time, sailor that he was, to avoid dramas, to avoid accidents, to avoid running aground, primarily because of his sailing skills and his navigational skills and a second sense. And that's why he was so fortunate on so many times. Sailing around the bottom of New Zealand was terrible. He really had a tough time down there. But he completed the circumnavigation of New Zealand, went back up to Cook Strait, what became Cook Strait, went into Ship Cove there, replenished the ship, repaired it, etc., and then decided it was time to go to Van Diemen's Land, where he knew that Tasman had left the coast there. By the way, Tasman, when he left the coast of Van Diemen's Land, had his carpenter swim ashore because it was so rough, and plant the Dutch flag in the coast of Tasmania on the beach there and leave. So Tasmania was first claimed by the Dutch. But fortunately, they didn't follow up. Cook decided he would sail to that point, hit land there, and discover what existed in that part of the world. Well, he got a typical Tasman Sea storm that we all know so much about now, and got blown off course, and actually realised that he was to the west of that point where Tasman had been on the coast of Tasmania, and sailed into Bass Strait. He then sighted the coast to the, which was the southeastern coast of the mainland of Australia, named Point Hicks without the E, and then they sailed up the coast. He named it Point Hicks because he said the first person to sight land, I will name it after them. just as with New Zealand, it was Young Nick, the surgeon's boy who spotted New Zealand, so they had Young Nick's head. So it was named Young Nick's head. He was only 14 or something. He also promised the first person to sight land in New Zealand a gallon of rum, but we don't know if Young Nick got the gallon of rum, but I'm sure it went down very well with someone. So off he went and sailed up the east coast of Australia. Now, we know he went to Botany Bay. He saw Botany Bay as being a great place to establish a colony. Sailed past Sydney, noted the harbour. Again, you've got to wonder, had he sailed into Sydney Harbour and seen it, might the English have come even sooner to Australia when they realised what a great harbour that was? Noticed Broken Bay, suggested that might be another site for a port, and continued on north. What intrigued him was when they were sailing in New Zealand, the Maoris were always persistently there, annoying them, seeing them, talking to them, harassing them, or being friendly on a number of occasions, whereas the Aboriginals just showed no interest whatsoever. Occasionally they showed a form of aggression, as they did in Botany Bay, but the rest of the time they come down, stand at the beach, look at this thing going past, and then turn around and walk back into the bush as though nothing had happened. So he found that quite intriguing. That voyage went on, as we know the story. He went back to England, he survived, and reported on Botany Bay, reported on his findings, and that was enough for them to decide on a second trip. But that there should be a second voyage of exploration looking for the Great Southern Land. When he got back to England, the voyage was heralded so greatly by the media and everyone and the public. It was such a successful voyage, no one had ever discovered so much. 26-year-old Banks suddenly got on this wave of success, because the media all of a sudden ignored Captain Cook and became Banks's voyage, Banks's success, everything else. And Cook's gone, oh, okay. So, but Banks was the hero of the voyage when they first got back to England. So, and deciding it would be the second voyage, there would be a second voyage, Banks immediately assumed that he would lead that voyage. Now, there's a very interesting story here that's come to light, and I won't dwell on it too long. But that was, he would lead that voyage, that there would be it would be another voyage of discovery, as I say. But he decided he would decide how the ship would be built. The ship was became Resolution. He ordered that another entire deck be placed at the aft end of the ship, so he and his 20 friends could be accommodated. Everyone said, you can't do that, the ship will be crank, it'll become unstable, so off you, please don't do it. But he said, no, that's what I want. So they did that, and as soon as the Banks was in the city, but they had to sail a ship down the river to the Thames, to the entrance, with a pilot, and Cook was on board and most of his men. They weren't even out of the Thames River, and every man to one said, we're not going to sea on this boat. It tried to capsize in the Thames River because it was so top heavy. It became apparent later that the reason for this became apparent to me, because when they ripped that deck off, Banks threw a huge tantrum, said, I'm not going if you're not going to do this. But it came apparent to me, and I think a lot of others, as to why this happened. Because when he arrived in Madeira, on the first stop, when the ship arrived with Cook as captain, and by the way, when that cabin was built for Banks, Cook was then moved up into the top deck into the equivalent of a kennel. It was Banks in charge of the voyage, and Cook was only sailing the ship, and that was it. So when Endeavour got to Madeira, he and the crew went ashore at one stage, and the locals said, there's been this guy here, a Mr. Burnett, a gentleman from England, and he arrived 3 months ago, which was about when Endeavour was due to leave England, and he said he was here to board Mr. Banks's ship, and they said he was a very strange person, so Cook couldn't work it out. It turns out that Mr. Burnett was Banks's mistress, dressed in men's clothing. So no wonder he wanted a comfortable cabin back up. But Banks actually believed that he could smuggle this quote-unquote man aboard for the rest of the voyage, and no one realised what was going on. So, yeah.
I think we better get him speared soon.
Okay, well, I'll hurry up. Sorry. So one, look, just buy the book. Yes, it was just getting good. But look. Anyway, for the third voyage, I'll just start. The second voyage, three times into the Antarctic Circle, down to 77 degrees, freezing cold. The men didn't have the gear, but they still went and they followed their leader. Amazing things down there with icebergs, snow and ice. And I'll give you one example. The snow and the ice, he was going down there looking for the southern land again. He actually got quite close to Antarctica and he assumed that there was land down there. But the ship, it was so cold and so damp, the sails were freezing. And every so often the ship was becoming top heavy with all the ice and the snow and everything else. And they had to shudder the ship, as I put it. They had to luff the ship up into the wind, so the sails flogged and all the ice came cascading onto the deck like broken glass out of a window, and the snow disappeared and off they'd go again. Three times into the Antarctic Circle. It was absolutely incredible. So he returned from that voyage very successfully again. The third voyage, well, he was retired. And the Admiralty asked him to become a fourth captain at the Greenwich Hospital. Cook didn't like that. He got land fever. The Admiralty came to him and said, please, can you give us an idea what boat and who should lead the next expedition? This was done over a lunch. And Cook turned around, and by the end of the lunch, he'd got the job. He decided he couldn't stay on shore, and he went off and led that fourth expedition. That was the one to go to the find the Northwest Passage over the top of North America, because if they found that and it was free of ice, England would get the benefit of trading with the East Indies by not having to go around Cape Horn. He was beaten by ice, a wall-to-wall, 20-foot-high stretch of ice from horizon to horizon, could not get through it, so returned. But instead of returning to the coast of North America and waiting for winter to pass, he'd already discovered the Sandwich Islands, and he then decided that he would go back there. Now, no one but Cook could really understand why, unless he decided he wanted to explore more of the Hawaiian Islands. It was there that he went to into the big bay there, where he anchored to prepare the ship for the next stage of the voyage, and they treated him like a god. But the ship then left after all of this, and they broke the foremast on Resolution, so they went back to the same bay. Now, having treated him like a god and given him so much food and equipment and everything to help him, they thought he was getting greedy and coming back to take more, and they were struggling with their food and everything. So they decided that this god was now a bad man. And Cook, they started stealing things, they started attacking the sailors. I'll just wrap up on this piece and how he came to die. So he then said, we can't have this, I want to want peace. So he went to the chief's hut on the land and said, please, can we sit down and talk about all this and try to settle things down? And so what happened, though, they were surrounded by all the rest of the islanders, who were very, very agitated. Then Cook said, well, look, please, let's go back aboard Resolution and talk about it there, so we're away from all these people and really get things calm. But the islanders assumed that move to take Cook back to Resolution, he was actually being kidnapped. Their chief was being kidnapped. That's why the primary reason for them attacking him on the beach. And that's how he came to be killed. So, folks, we are over time a little bit. I'd love to go on, but I think I can take questions and fill in any gaps for you. But it's been a pleasure, and I'm sorry it's a little bit rushed, but it's a 120,000-word book. So it's a big story.
Thanks, Rob. So we come to questions and discussion. We've got till the top of the hour, so we've got to be brief with our questions and brief with our responses, and just paint us a picture of Cook. I mean, a very brave man, brilliant sailor, but was he just bored with the wife and kids? I mean, did he just want to get away from home? Or you come back here.
Look, he was a very loving father, and there was a wonderful relationship, obviously, between them after they were married. They had six children. Three died in infancy, and then the other three, I'll just give you what happened here, and it's rather sad. James, 30 years old, he died when a boat capsized on the Solent at age 30, and he'd just been appointed captain of a Royal Navy vessel and was sailing that vessel, and a storm came up. He died, he drowned. Nathaniel, age 15, he was aboard HMAS Thunderer, they were struck by a hurricane in the West Indies, and I think something like, Paul will correct me here, I think something like 1,000 sailors died or something like that in this hurricane, and he was one of the people who died. Elizabeth, aged 4 years, she died. Joseph died at age 1 month. George died aged 3 months. Hugh died of scarlet fever aged 17. Now, Cook was 50 years old when he died. Elizabeth remained a lonely widow and a reclusive widow until her death in 1830, aged 93.
Just stay there. Just stay there. Yep. Just question here. Yep.
Rob, Cook, and perhaps more particularly Banks, painted a particularly rosy picture of Botany Bay.
Yeah.
We all know it was almost a sandy desert.
Yes.
But they described tall timbers and water and bountiful animals and And when Philip arrived, no such thing existed. How would you explain that?
I think it was more Banks than Cook who did the explanation of Botany Bay. I think, again, Banks saw this great expanse of water. I think he assumed a lot of it was deep water. And I don't know where this theory of tall timbers came from, but the big thing was they obviously didn't work out that there was no fresh water there, and that was more important than anything. So I think in reading what I've read, much of it was due to Banks, and they said, well, because Cook was away when they decided that they wanted to set up the colony, and Banks said Botany Bay and explained why.
Now, I should have mentioned that Janet Grundy's got some copies of Cook from Sailor to Legend, which I'm sure the author would be happy to sign. Right down the back.
Thanks, Rob. I've read a lot about Captain Cook, and I've recently watched a video that's on the shelves of the Maritime Museum.
Yeah.
Especially I got for you, because in this video, they have James Cook claiming possession of Australia in Botany Bay. And my understanding is he did that on possession island.
He did. Yeah. That's right, Paul, isn't it? Yeah,
well,
there he is.
Yeah.
Well, that's wrong, because he did it on Possession Island and he claimed New Wales.
Well, this is clearly a task for the new ABC fact-checking unit. Send him a note. Right down the back corner there, yeah.
Rob, thank you very much. It's been a fascinating presentation. On the first voyage, when he was heading west to pick up where Tasman was 120 years before.
Yeah.
And he came across to the coast of New Zealand.
Yeah.
How did he know that that was New Zealand, where Tasman had been, rather than the east coast of Terra Incognita?
Because primarily the latitude that he had for Tasman was further to the west. And he worked it out from there, but the weather had forced him a bit to the north of that latitude. So he said, well, then once they went into what became Poverty Bay, we will sail south to the latitude that Tasman gave and find what's there. Now, if we can get across to that latitude, so I will. If there's still land there, then I'll turn around, I believe, and come back to the north. But when they got down to that latitude, he looked at the coast and said, I don't think it's any worth our while going further south now. We'll go up. And they went right round New Zealand first. They went anti-clockwise around the North Island and then clockwise around the South Island.
Question here.
I just wonder if members of our Navy nowadays are trained in the sort of seamanship so that they could manage to sail from somewhere to somewhere if they, if they didn't have a compass or didn't have any equipment.
I think so, but it's not to any great degree, because you can put a GPS unit in your pocket now, but I think, look, all our sailors, I know a lot of our sailors are trained in sailing whalers and small boats, etc., etc., and so if they got into strife, I think they would have sufficient knowledge to work out generally how to get out of trouble. But that said, you must admire the ability of the likes of Bligh for his voyage across to Timor, and even Cook on board Endeavour with what he did and his great navigation. In fact, Cape Maria van Diemen, the northwest corner of New Zealand, Cook wanted to position that as accurately as he could, because van Diemen placed it there. And so he went to that point and took the Latin long, and using GPS today, that latitude and longitude, the latitude is perfect and the longitude's only 3 miles out. Yeah.
Question.
Did Cook have the advantage of Lydia Harrison?
Yeah, he did, and that did help him.
He had Harrison's what?
A Kendall, the timepiece, the clock, okay. The chronometer. Oh, right, and he had the Kendall there, and yes, he did. Yeah, yeah.
There's a question. Yeah.
You've already touched upon it, but I found it to be quite intriguing. Nobody's really explained why there wasn't an obsession with locating water. I would have thought that explorers generally would need to restock whenever there was an opportunity.
Yeah.
The lack of searching in Botany Bay nearby,
yeah,
for a water source, so that nothing I've ever read, and obviously you.
Yeah. That surprised me too. But I think they were able to replenish the supply, water supplies for the ship, and maybe they assumed that there was a lot of water around there, but they did have a source of water there. But as we know, Philip arrived and said, well, A, it's too shallow, and B, where's the water supply? And we know all too well it took the tank stream to make the decision about Sydney Cove.
Right down the back, yeah.
Rob, I want to comment on the trends of Venus.
Yeah.
I'm not 100% certain about that, but I thought what happened was that wasn't a huge success. The reason was it was an extremely cloudy time and they were unable to see that, and that was the motivation. So what are we going to do now? And that was key motivation for Cook to say, well, I've got something else now.
On all my research, that's not the case. I'm just saying that the going through his journal and everything else, he does note that, as a precaution, mind you, he sent two other crews, small teams, to different points, one along the coast and one to a nearby island, so that if it was cloudy at what became Point Venus, then they had an opportunity also to get an observation from there. But all three came back with very good reports, very accurate reports.
So we're getting towards the end. There's a question here. Yes,
you mentioned this, Mrs. Burnett.
Mrs. Burnett.
Got chopped off by Jared.
No, I just was suggesting it was time to kill Cook off because
Banks and the mistress get offloaded in Madeira.
Banks wasn't on the ship. You see, when they rebuilt the ship and he arrived, he heard that the ship had turned a hard right out of the end of the Thames and gone into Sheerness, where Cook finally spoke up. Cook was very much a man of the Navy and wouldn't really voice his opinions, but finally he said, look, something's got to be done. And others just said, this is a bathtub, we're not going to see in this. And so they just did a right-hand turn and went straight to starboard, went straight into Sheerness, and they started ripping the superstructure off the boat and rebuilding it. Banks came down from London, having heard that this was happening, and there's quotes in here from people who observed him, and he was literally throwing a tantrum on the dock about, well, I'm not going then, and this and that and something else, and he didn't, and that was it. There was no great animosity between him and Cook, though, for that matter, and they did make up later, because as we know, they remained good friends for a long, long while.
Rob, just a quick question. Your archival sources, where did you draw most of your archival?
Oh, dear, oh, dear. I had primarily from, because this book's about Cook, primarily from his journals. And that was the backbone, the basic skeleton of the book. And from that, I went off on numerous tangents where I would come to points and I'd just go looking for information on particular areas. I must say today, life as an author is a lot easier because of the web. But at the same time, because of the web, Your research at times is made a lot more difficult because you have to double check the accuracy. And this is where Paul was so kind with so much of what I did. Because you went and you looked and you said, wow, isn't that interesting? And it was the same with Bligh. There were a few things with the Bligh book where I've gone, I didn't know that. And you'd go down a track and look for it and it was just wrong.
So most of Cook's journals are located where?
There are some here. Yeah. Well, Paul can answer that. Do you mind answering us Cook's journals, Paul, exactly where they are?
In Australia.
Yeah.
There's various versions of each journal.
So I want to pick this up on the podcast. Paul Brunton saying there are various versions of each journal, both in Australia and in Britain.
Yes. Yeah. That's what I thought.
Well, Australia means Sydney, doesn't it? They're nearly all here.
Well, in Canberra also.
And in Canberra.
Yeah. And a lot of his journals.
So the National Library and the State Library of New South Wales.
Yeah, and a lot of his journals have now been published. There's a book brought out with many of his journals included in that.
Okay, so there's a question down there, and there's one in the middle. Yes?
Just a comment about Botany Bay. It was originally called Stingray Bay.
Correct.
And Cook noted it was shallow.
Yes.
And that it was just inside Cook's landing place in Botany Bay. There was a watering place there.
Yes, that's right.
He didn't note in his journal that it was water, but it was not very quiet, it was brackish.
Yes.
And my question is, I'm interested in your view of Cook's personality, like his kind of fictional sort of person he was. And finally, do you have any, can you elucidate, there's a controversy about when Cook died, his journal was left unwritten for some months or some weeks before he died. And there's some speculation that he had some sort of mental instability or some turn at the time that which crew destroyed the journal or.
So there's a question about Cook's personality and whether his final journal was destroyed because he might have been suffering some kind of mental instability?
Well, there were periods in leading up to the time of his death as he was going through the Pacific where their crew were questioning his mental stability. He went to Easter Island. There was concern about him then. There's numerous theories on what the problem was there. But there's speculation about his journals being written up leading up to that period by others. There's enough information there, regardless, to be accurate on what happened prior to his death.
There's a question in the middle there.
For the transit of Venus, where were the other two points?
Where were the other two points?
One was in Europe, and the other one was in, from memory, Canada. But I concentrated on the Tahiti one, obviously. Or it started when Wallace discovered it. He called it King George III Island. Then it became Otaheite because others started realising that the Tahitians called it Otaheite, and then obviously it led to Tahiti.
Okay, we've got to be very brief here.
Did he make critical observations of the Australian Aborigines?
Yes, he did, to a considerable degree. One was that some were aggressive. The others was that... it's in his journals at length that they showed little interest in their presence of the English. But also he made considerable notes on their skin, the fact that they were still quite nomadic, that they hadn't discovered sail for their canoes, that the majority of their canoes were incredibly basic in design and construction. So he gave a very good overview of the Aborigines, as did Banks.
So you've been remarkably prolific with books on Bligh and Flinders and Cook and more besides. What's next? Catherine Feathersword, or...
If I tell you, I'm going to have to kill you. No, there is another...
Buddy, watch...
I've got another book I've actually started. I know Helen won't let me tell you.
No, but the general theme...
I can't tell them, can I, Helen? I can tell them. Oh, this is giving away. There might be another publisher here. you're happy with me telling them?
Well, that's all right. We'll just do a bit.
No. I'll tell you what it is. A day or so after I finished this book, I was talking to Helen a lot about what's going to be next. What wanted to do maritime history again. My wonderful secretary and I went to lunch up on the Gold Coast where I now live. I used to live on the northern beaches of Sydney. And I was just having the first glass of champagne, and I don't know where it came from, but a bolt of lightning hit me. And I said to her, what about the First Fleet? And she's gone, that's it. And I sent Helen a text message straight away, and she said, you got it. I know that I can do the First Fleet story from a very different perspective. Again, there are quite a few books out there, but I know I can do it from a different perspective, and it's a lot of opportunity to create a very exciting book.
There is one final question, yep.
Well, while you're on that writing history from the sailor's point of view, Cook did the most amazing voyages and explored. Now he's an explorer, but did he pioneer things in the sailing profession? I mean, in terms of what changed in the way in which they made use of their time aboard boats, and did things improve?
Not so much in that area, but he really was very good with his crew. He was a great leader, and again, that's partly because he'd come from the lower deck. But his biggest achievement, which we all hear about, but there's a bit of misunderstanding on that, was the fact that he essentially cured scurvy. But it was by chance that happened, not by just the fact that this is how it's going to happen. And he saw it in his research as being through diet. A lot of people say, well, it was vitamin C, but back then they didn't know about vitamin C. But Cook thought that if he could change the diet and present different foods to the crew that they would normally have, because it was nothing on a voyage, an expedition of three ships, for 1,000 men to die from scurvy. And yet Cook lost none in that first voyage. Interestingly, I'll give you these figures very quickly because they are interesting. On that first voyage, they got back to England. Where is it? I won't waste time. In essence, the numbers were that 38 of the crew had died by the time they got back to England. But those 38 primarily had died from dysentery, which they contracted in Batavia. And his diet, which for many they turned their noses up originally, but they started eating it because they realised it was working, no one was getting scurvy, was sauerkraut and wort, which was a malt extract and things like that. So, yeah, he really did pioneer it.
But he also changed the schedule for the...
He changed the watch system, yes.
The man who cared about his crew.
He absolutely.
And found ways to make them do better
yes.
at what they were doing.
He split them into three watches, so they got more rest. He also insisted on great hygiene. They had to be clean. They were called on to come on deck and scrub their clothes on deck. If it was bed linen, they wrapped it all up together and threw it over. Sure. Excuse me. Threw it over behind the ship on a rope, and it got washed by, I don't know what happened, it was your bed linen and the salt in the bed linen, it wouldn't have been too good, would it? But that's so he insisted on cleanliness, smoking the ship regularly to keep the below decks clean as well.
Okay, many thanks. We're right on time, so without question, James Cook is a fine man and brilliant at his profession, so it's important that we've got another look at Cook from Ron Mundell, has told the story in a very enlightening and invigorating way. So I'm sure that Cook, from sailor to legend, will be successful. Janet Grundy's got some copies here tonight. I'm sure you'll do what you say you're going to do, and I hope you'll come back again in the future. But for tonight, thank you and well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.